Thank you, Paris, for your warm welcome, and to the Lipsey Architecture Center Buffalo for its support of our special preservation works tours this weekend, and for the opportunity to speak on the Richardson Olmsted campus about the past, present, and future of Kirkbride Plan Hospitals. With the expertise gathered in this room, I don't in any way presume to tell you more about your ROC than many of you already know. Rather, what I hope to do is to place the Buffalo State Asylum within the broader context of the Kirkbride Plan Hospitals, a family of around 75 kindred structures built across North America and Australia during the 19th century. I've been told that the background of the Kirkbride Plan and its originator, Thomas Story Kirkbride, has been a topic less discussed at Buffalo, which is understandable given the long shadows cast by H.H. Richardson and Frederick Law Olmsted. It's a subject to which I provide a somewhat unusual vantage, not only because of my familial relation, but also because of the path of my own research and practice. While I've been aware of Thomas Story's influence almost all my entire life, when I reflect on the path of my own work and my fascination with the interdependence of the mind and the built environment, the parallels are at sometimes downright spooky. Through the three parts of this talk, origins, phantoms, and afterlives, I'll highlight the aspirations behind the architecture and the landscape design of the Kirkbrides, as they're popularly known, the complexity of their histories, and the significance of remembering those who have been lost and preserving those that remain. I'm also delighted to share a few examples of recent and ongoing adaptive reuse at sites where Kirkbrides had been at risk of demolition not so long ago. During several years, when it seemed inevitable that we'd lose these structures, the renovation of Buffalo's ROC offered a shining example of adaptive reuse, for which it deservedly received a series of honors, including the Distinguished Dry House Foundation Award, and it was even considered the most interesting place in the world. Fortunately, we can now add several other stories that are trending positive. I say trending because we know the tide can turn swiftly, as it did with ROC's Hotel Henry. As the pandemic underscored in bright neon, buildings, like humans, are fragile, and even a preservation success story like the ROC is not immune to abrupt reversals of fortune and can disappear with astonishing speed. That is why the continued support of organizations such as the Lipsey Architecture Center and Preservation Works is so critical. Thank you all for coming out for this event and our special weekend of tours at a significant turning point in the ongoing adaptive transformation of the ROC. With this visit, to the Buffalo State Asylum, I have now visited a third of the surviving Kirkbride Plan hospitals, and despite what I think I know about these remarkable structures, with eyes and ears open, I learn so much more with each visit, since every community with a Kirkbride has its ardent advocates, its knowledgeable historians, as well as its critics. With each visit, my respect for Thomas Story Kirkbride and his commitment to the mentally ill deepens, and I'm no less humbled by the committed efforts of my colleagues at Preservation Works, our members, and partnering organizations to ensure that our past has a future. So here we go. We'll have a few haunting twists and turns to our story, alternative histories of what-ifs and if-onlys, but trust that we'll arrive at the end with an even stronger appreciation of these immense and awe-inspiring structures, the lessons they offer, and the lives they have yet to live. During the second half of the 19th century, approximately 75 Kirkbride Plan hospitals were constructed to treat the mentally ill across the United States, Canada, and Australia, according to the formal arrangements proposed by Dr. Thomas Story Kirkbride and the patient-centered principles of the moral treatment that he and social reformer Dorothea Dix tirelessly advocated. While they were certainly not alone in their efforts to elicit greater respect for the mentally ill and alleviate their suffering, Kirkbride and Dix were complementary forces who, for a brief window of time, willed that humane vision into being. Embodying Enlightenment Quaker beliefs in the therapeutic powers of architecture, beauty, landscape, and respectful care, the Kirkbride Plan generated elegant and massive echelon-wing structures that embraced local climate and site conditions to provide patients with prevailing breezes, plentiful sunlight, and expansive vistas of bucolic landscaped grounds that often included a self-sustaining farm for food and occupational therapy, supplied with greenhouses, workshops, and other innovative amenities. Kirkbrides provided a dignified place for the placeless. Yet remarkable though they were, these structures also are permeated with disturbing histories and poignantly exemplify how one generation's earnest aspirations, embodied in their constructed environments, may unintentionally lay the foundations for future generations' dystopias. Despite their promising origins, the demise of Kirkbride Plan hospitals came to symbolize the decay of the American mental health care system. As such, those that remain offer three-dimensional documents of the complex challenges to providing physical and social infrastructures for mental health care. And it is for this very reason that it is essential to preserve and repurpose the hospitals rather than tear them down. Their erasure, whether deliberately or by neglect, is tantamount to the repression of a very real, very difficult cultural past that continues to haunt our present and foreseeably our future. Close multisensorial documentation of the buildings, their grounds, and the traces of their occupation render legible not only the vestiges of actual past, they also lend voice to what might have been or what might yet be. To understand the origins of the Kirkbride Plan and the buildings themselves, it's valuable to appreciate the origins of their originator, since without them, Thomas Story would not have been, the Kirkbride Plan would not have been, nor would I be standing here with you speaking of Kirkbrides. To retrace what a Kirkbride is, we briefly alight to a village at the border of England and Scotland on the Solway Firth in Cumbria, historically a semi-autonomous district perched at the hinterlands of established governance. The wee village of Kirkbride was named after the Church of St. Bridget, built in 1189 of the current era, directly over and with the ruins of an ancient Roman fortress at the westernmost point of the Stanegate Road, built 1,000 years earlier to support the Roman forces at Hadrian's Wall, which was less than 5 miles away and about 1,150 miles from Rome. For the first twist in our story, we revisit the 17th century, 1652, to be exact. Quakerism has erupted amid the political and religious civil war that has consumed the British Isles, and amid a blossom of alternative spiritual groups, the newly wedded Matthew and Magdalene Kirkbride joined the early converts to Quakerism, influenced by the charismatic visions and personality of George Fox, the founder of the Society of Friends. With their iconoclastic, some argued blasphemic, rejection of religious and political hierarchy, their refusal to swear legal oaths, and their conviction that men and women are equals, the Friends caused great distress to the English law and social order and frequently landed in English jails. On one level, the Quakers' commitment to creating physical and legal infrastructures for the public good drew directly from their own poignant experiences of incarceration and ill treatment at the hands of the authorities in England. Yet on a deeper philosophical level, the Friends were compelled to establish and improve public infrastructures around health and justice due to their belief that each living person, wealthy or poor, learned or ignorant, sane or insane, model citizen or criminal, represents an inner light that deserves respectful care, especially when that light is less able to preserve itself, as in the case of the mentally ill. Yet, if not for an unusual convergence of factors, perhaps there might not have been Quakers at all. Intriguing research has retraced how an extended weather pattern of cold winters and damp springs across England and Scandinavia from 1647 to 55 produced ideal circumstances for the proliferation of ergot of rye, a natural hallucinogenic fungus that produces visions similar to those described and preached by George Fox and his rapidly expanding followers. Ergot of rye also produces foaming at the mouth, indecipherable speech, and intense trembling throughout the body, fits for which Quakers earned their initially derogatory nickname, a moniker that Quakers quickly owned from their detractors as a badge of honor in a characteristically rye Quaker twist. At the time, rye was the cheapest grain used for bread for the common people. Only the wealthy could afford wheat, and rye grew well in English lowlands, including Kirkbride. Rye was also imported from Scandinavia and exported through port cities such as Bristol, which became a hub of Quaker influence and a point of departure for Quakers emigrating to North America. In 1681, at age 19, the same age that George Fox experienced his spiritual seeking, Joseph Kirkbride, son of Matthew and Magdalene, abandons his apprenticeship to a carpenter and boards the Bristol factor with a boatload of Quakers to pursue the egalitarian holy experiment of William Penn. In December 1681, Joseph arrives in what would become Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Now, without that somewhat tenuous chain of events, Thomas Story Kirkbride would not have descended as the fourth generation from Joseph's second wife, Sarah Stacy, nor would I have descended as the 10th generation from his third wife, Mary Fletcher. Dr. Kirkbride's efforts to cure mental illness through more humane and respectful treatments and settings are profoundly inspiring, and his meticulous attention to the interdependence of mental and physical infrastructures resonates with my lifelong fascination with the interplay of architecture, memory, and identity. Although I began working in architecture with my father's firm when I was 12, it was my grandmother, Beatrice Headley Kirkbride, who inspired my curiosity in Quaker structures. Through B, I learned about Thomas Story and his hospital from a young age. Having descended herself from a family that had also converted to Quakerism in the mid-1600s and originated from the opposite end of Hadrian's Wall at Headley-on-the-Hill, Beatrice was a committed activist with a passion for the built environment. On the 171st anniversary of Thomas Story Kirkbride's birth in 1980, Beatrice was an invited guest at the rededication of Byberry State Hospital's Building C1 as the Thomas Story Kirkbride Building. Pictured here in her trademark no-nonsense muumuu, Beatrice came to architectural history late in life, in her 50s, at a pivotal moment in Philadelphia's history, the creation of the Historical Commission and the transformation of the oldest parts of the city. To describe B as a tenacious architectural detective would be an understatement. Her dogged research on the origins of Philadelphia Independence Hall area with Charles E. Peterson and her efforts to protect a primarily black neighborhood from city planner Edmund Bacon's plan for an expressway, which was ultimately defeated, was all-consuming. For her civic activism in the built environment, Bee was recognized as Philadelphia's Woman of the Year in 1983. Across the 1980s, her preservationist zeal centered on Eastern State Penitentiary, a source of passion that she and I shared. When the city reopened the building in the fall of 1989 for public discussions on what to do with it, we toured it together and argued over the most appropriate way to repurpose it. Eastern State became the subject of my master's thesis in architecture at the University of Pennsylvania, also Thomas Story's alma mater, where he studied surgery. And though I didn't know it then, my project, a curiosity shop that inverted the isolative panoptical principles of Eastern State, was the seed of not only one, but many projects built and written. Looking back, I realize these pursuits have echoed Thomas Story's work in uncanny ways. My fascination with the relationship of the mind and built environments, and specifically how architectural ornament provides an interface between communal memory and personal identity, has fueled a series of research and design projects that extended the arc of my thesis project, including my open access multimedia book, Architecture in Memory, in which I examined two Renaissance memory chambers in the Marches region of Italy, and the realization of my Master of Architecture thesis 25 years later through the Morbid Anatomy Museum in Brooklyn, New York. Now, through projects such as the memorial planning groups at Greystone and Hudson, my path has converged with the Kirkbride Plan hospitals themselves, once again, in collaboration with passionate, like-minded colleagues at Preservation Works, my curious and committed students at Parsons, and with the broader Kirkbride community. So, what is a Kirkbride? In 1854, Thomas Story Kirkbride, a trained surgeon raised by an Orthodox Quaker family near Philadelphia, published his influential treatise on the ideal construction and management of a hospital for the mentally ill, concisely titled On the Construction, Organization, and General Arrangements of Hospitals for the Insane, with Some Remarks on Insanity and Its Treatment. This 80-page treatise expanded on an article he'd written 7 years earlier, in which he laid out the basic philosophical and physiological characteristics that would define what Kirkbride himself called the linear plan, yet over time has come to be known as the Kirkbride plan. This guide to the design and operation of a hospital for the insane, Kirkbride refused to use the term asylum, since he deeply believed that mental illness is a disease that can be treated, reflected his experience as the first superintendent of the newly constructed Pennsylvania Hospital for the Insane, as well as his deep-seated Quaker spiritual belief that every patient deserves respectful care. The origins of this respectful care, known as the moral treatment, may be traced back through the Frankfurt Retreat, one of the earliest hospitals for the insane in the United States, where Kirkbride served his medical residency, to the York Retreat in England, also run by Quakers from 1792, which Dorothea Dix had visited in person during her tour of England to study asylums and almshouses. The simple layout of these two structures, with a central main building for administration and short wings, was to provide the most elemental physical arrangement that Kirkbride expanded into what became known as the Kirkbride Plan. This elemental layout may be seen in Utica State Hospital and also in Hayes Hall in Buffalo, a former almshouse. According to Kirkbride, the role of an architect in hospital planning was primarily the ornamentation or the styling of the physical envelope of the building, while the actual operational layout and workings, its day-to-day flows, were best determined by the superintendent. This led to curious variations and evolutions of the Kirkbride plan. The categorization of Kirkbrides proposed on websites such as the Asylum Project, original, modified, and improved, seem clear and reasonable at first glance. Yet these categories become extremely muddy upon closer examination. Typically, original Kirkbrides followed the shallow linear echelon plan organization set forth in Kirkbride's 1854 treatise, represented by Samuel Sloan's plans for Tuscaloosa, and you see also manifest by Trenton, New Jersey, at the top of this particular group. Modified Kirkbrides, which you see toward the middle of this poster that we are producing at Preservation Works, followed the Civil War when the American Medical Superintendents of American Institutions for the Insane, an organization that Kirkbride helped found and lead, formally raised Kirkbride's stipulated maximum of 200 patients to 600 in 1866, despite Kirkbride's resolute protest. The increasingly mammoth modified Kirkbrides were typically V-shaped, though some featured atypical wing connectors, curves, and angles. Meanwhile, the improved Kirkbrides featured deepened setbacks, centralized rear support buildings, and numerous technological advances in steam and gas services that T.S. Kirkbride detailed in the 341 pages of the second edition of his treatise, published in 1880, 3 years before his death. Yet many of the improved Kirkbrides actually preceded the 1880 treatise, which served to document rather than to prescribe the innovations. Notably, the second edition also underscored Kirkbride's rejection of several developments in AMSI's policies and medical health facilities, in addition to reaffirming his recommended maximum occupancy of 250 patients, Kirkbride objected to the creation of hospitals solely for chronic patients, such as Willard, New York, and he advocated the echelon plan against the rising popularity of cottage-style buildings. In truth, there is not a smooth chronological progression of the Kirkbride plan, and there are numerous anomalies that render easy categorization a pipe dream. First of all, Thomas Story's own first hospital, which in Philadelphia became simply known as the Kirkbride, wasn't a Kirkbride at all. It had been designed and built by Isaac Holden in 1840 without any contribution from Kirkbride, who was merely hired to be its first superintendent. In fact, after experiencing all the flaws in Holden's design, Kirkbride articulated the physical and operational principles that defined the Kirkbride plan. There are other early Kirkbrides, including Taunton and Northampton in that previous poster, and Kirkbride's own second hospital in West Philadelphia, which he did shape in collaboration with Samuel Sloan, who might be noted was also a carpenter on Eastern State Penitentiary and a foreman on the first Kirkbride hospital designed by Holden. That structure of Kirkbrides already exhibited features of the so-called improved Kirkbrides almost 30 years before the second edition was published. Now here you see both of the Kirkbrides side by side. I've put them together to join them so you can see how number one, number two do not really in any way reflect the more familiar tenets of the echelon plan, three wing setback hospital. They represent ideas Kirkbride was designing, but they manifest complexities that are reflected in many of the other Kirkbrides as well. In sum, the Kirkbride plan was not an orthodoxy, but rather a theme, physical and operational, that was varied across a spectrum of local site conditions and community needs and desires. Kirkbride supported evolving diagnoses and treatments of mental illnesses and little understood predicaments, from developmental disabilities to personality disorders to criminal behaviors. And their individual layouts are often changed over time as well. Structures such as Brattleboro in Vermont, whose construction began in 1838, well before Kirkbride published his first article, nonetheless morphed over time to appear more Kirkbridean. The Kirkbride at Austin, Texas, truncated by the Civil War, never grew into a full-fledged Kirkbride. Hudson, too, was trimmed prematurely due to politics and cost overruns. A number of Kirkbrides don't conveniently fit into any categories. Nonconformists like Dayton, Ohio, and Dixmont offered condensed layouts where the echelon stepped back and forward. And Oregon State was even less echelon-like. Spencer, West Virginia, was a continuous straight line. And I show this photograph, which is a bit blurry, but it's remarkably powerful because you see the juxtaposition of the rural conditions of the United States, where many of the hospitals were built and provided a remarkable departure with its very carefully designed landscape features, the very Renaissance or Italianate fountain in front of this mammoth structure, which was remarkably distinct from the very rural, rustic settlements and houses of many of the patients who occupied Spencer and the other Kirkbrides. And although Kirkbride loathed the shift toward cottage style that the next generation of superintendents advocated, there are even hybrids of Kirkbride cottage style, including Callan Hospital in Sydney, Australia, Topeka, Kansas, which you might find seems a little familiar to this particular friend, Buffalo's own ROC. Now, it's curious that there were even evolutions within the lives of the planning of the buildings themselves. This is an earlier plan of the Buffalo State Asylum, where you see a slightly different configuration, both of the landscape and of the buildings themselves. And not only that, as we were really introduced yesterday by one of our ROC docents, Jeff, he described how even though from the outside, Buffalo's ROC seems perfectly symmetrical in its materiality, the evolution of the building that was built over time, one wing at a time, led to distinctions among the spatial arrangements and interiors as they placed more and more patients in common rooms, such as in the women's wing. Now, it's also interesting how the buildings were uniquely built. Buffalo, one wing at a time, and in Traverse City, the entire structure from the ground up. Traverse City was built later, 1885, and one can only speculate that they learned from earlier processes, for example, at Hudson, where the cost overruns led to a truncated building. So in Traverse City, they made sure the entire building went up from the ground to avoid that kind of truncation. So these sites were learning from one another. Some of the architects were working at multiple sites. They exchanged information. The communities learned from one another as they built their Kirkbrides. Now, it's fascinating to sort among the extended family of Kirkbrides in their local contexts to better appreciate their unique histories while also better understanding the difficult histories that bound them together. Kirkbrides represent a uniquely American typology of an asylum that co-evolved with the rapid growth of the United States. Building a Kirkbride often built communities within and around it. Typically, constructed with local materials from stone, brick, and concrete quarried or produced on-site or close by, and with lumber from old-growth forests, many of the structures developed symbiotically with neighboring towns, stimulating their economies, construction trades, and civic identities. Consequently, fledgling towns and cities competed for the opportunity to have a Kirkbride hospital in their backyards, with its promise of jobs and state funding. Kirkbride Plan hospitals manifested a generous, if utopian, confidence in the power of architecture to restore and enhance mental well-being. Yet they also represented a pragmatic agenda. In the 1840s, the medical profession in the United States was in its infancy, and trained doctors sought to establish credibility amid the popularity of mesmerists, charlatans, and assorted nostrums. By their awe-inspiring size, layout, ornamental detailing, and technological innovations, the structures instilled confidence in patients, their families, and initially, the taxpaying public. And Dr. Kirkbride and his fellow superintendents utilized them to facilitate the moral treatment by strategically distributing patients according to the nature and degree of their illnesses, and by carefully structuring daily life at the institution. Formally trained as a physician with a strong interest in surgery and not as a psychiatrist or architect, Kirkbride considered the workings of the hospital from a physiological perspective through the natural flows of air and light and the innovative mechanics of plumbing and heating and later gas and steam, while also focusing on the flows of everyday life, the daily regimen of patients, doctors, and staff. The signature batwing configuration improved natural ventilation to more effectively disperse the miasma of foul odor that was popularly believed to be the source of many illnesses. Kirkbride was also acutely mindful of the less tangible psychological influences of physical architecture and sought to reduce a patient's sense of constraint and containment by promoting an overall sense of openness and generosity. The patient-centered ethos is evidenced in numerous details, as at the Athens State Hospital, where architect Levy T. Schofield followed Kirkbride's advance that methods of containment, such as metal window bars, be treated with aesthetically mindful discretion. Among other architectural features prescribed by Dr. Kirkbride, the amusement room was physically and therapeutically central. Kirkbride considered theatrical performances invaluable to lighten patients' moods and he pioneered the use of magic lantern therapy to stimulate curiosity and mental healing. Kirkbride's innovative approach to photography was based on linkages he saw between the eye, brain, and mind. And yet, unlike many of his contemporaries, Kirkbride prohibited photographs of his patients. His use of photography in the magic lantern shows were for patients, not of patients. In this regard, Kirkbride's uses of architecture and technology to restore mental well-being offer a striking exception to Michel Foucault's characterizations of the panopticism in 19th century institutions. Although Kirkbride's approach was exceptional, it should also be understood in the context of 18th and 19th century Philadelphia. The Society of Friends was keenly focused on creating model hospitals and penitentiaries for both spiritual and pragmatic reasons. Those who recover may become valuable citizens, Kirkbride urged. If they do not add directly to the wealth of the state, they at least support their families. Those who become incurable are often, during a long life, a source of constant expense to the public, and not unfrequently, their families also become a public burden. Unfortunately, over time, the latter part of Kirkbride's statement became increasingly true. And as the need for more hospitals increased, the likelihood for recovery at an asylum sharply decreased, Kirkbride plan or not. By the late 19th century, public confidence in the nation's mental health care system and its asylums had deteriorated. The places for the placeless had become, in Andrew Scull's terms, convenient places for inconvenient people. It isn't possible in a single talk to account for all of the forces, social, political, medical, and architectural, that haunt the Kirkbrides and have led to the demolition of over half of the original hospitals. In previous lectures, I've detailed the many phantoms that haunt the Kirkbrides, but for today, I'll summarize how so many slippery slopes converged by historical twists and in slower, more insidious turns, to undermine the early promise of these structures. Despite the noble intent of their builders and the generosity of their designs, Kirkbride Plan hospitals now haunt the popular imagination due to an abysmal cocktail of overcrowding, institutional neglect, and questionable medical procedures. During the first half of the 20th century, the majority of American psychiatric hospitals, including Kirkbride's, devolved into frightening dystopias, offering cautionary reminders of the frailties of human infrastructures and the perils of bureaucratization and an overly generous confidence in architectural determinism. With the hindsight 150 years of Ford's, the charming imagery of Victorian-era life at Kirkbride's is in itself haunting. A plenitude of photographs and postcards, all staged with care, offer genteel visions of idyllic retreat and hypernormality, with golf outings, croquet, carriage rides, garden pavilions, craft work, resident brass bands, and costume balls. Given the earnest and egalitarian aspirations for these buildings and the progressive treatments, one may wonder how it all went so wrong. Foremost, we're haunted that these hospitals were rarely allowed to perform at Dr. Kirkbride's emphatically prescribed maximum occupancy of 250 patients per state hospital. Even the facilities designed for this capacity, such as Massachusetts Taunton State Hospital, were quickly oversubscribed. At its opening in 1854, Taunton received 330 patients, placing the building at 32% above its capacity and its staff at an immediate disadvantage. Reports soon emerged documenting the unjust uses of the new facilities to filter out recent immigrants. As early as 1854, a Massachusetts commission on lunacy had reported that Irish immigrants were disproportionately represented in the state's asylums. In the Boston Lunatic Hospital, for example, 80% of the inmates were Irish, compared with 31% of Boston's population. Over time, the insidious use of asylums for racial profiling and suppression became enmeshed in the nation's mental health care. The data pictured here from St. Elizabeth's reflects the segregation of blacks and whites at the high point of its occupancy of 7,778 patients on March 23rd of 1963. And the 1926 document reflect how the only federal Kirkbride hospital in the nation's capital was used to suppress indigenous peoples who refused to comply with social norms and with the territorial expansion of the United States. As Leila Taylor has observed, every country has its ghosts. In the United States, the asylums offered another vehicle to build its foundation over the graves of brown people with the enslavement of black people who didn't choose to be here. The pattern of overpopulation was soon turbocharged by the catastrophic impact of the Civil War, which generated a scale of slaughter and atrocities previously unimagined and left the medical establishment at a loss for terms to describe their psychological repercussions for war veterans and family members. The industrialization of warfare during the Civil War accelerated the fabrication and distribution of products in northern states by an expanding network of railways, and it also spawned the bureaucratic infrastructures necessary to construct new state psychiatric hospitals for the tens of thousands who were directly and indirectly traumatized by the war. New mammoth facilities and cottage-scaled structures could not be built quickly enough in the wake of further national traumas, including the financial panic of 1873, which actually centered on the overexpansion and financing of train lines themselves. By the end of the 19th century, individual asylum populations soared into the thousands, overwhelming the capacity for the buildings and their staff to perform as conceived. The conscientious care provided at Taunton and other early Kirkbride hospitals gradually devolved into custodial management, and an increasing number of patients spent the remainder of their lives at state facilities rather than returning to the world as intended. Combined with new admissions, the unanticipated increase of chronic patients contributed to an insidious systemic entropy at individual Kirkbrides and across hospitals nationwide. Also unanticipated was the astonishing ease and convenience with which patients were committed by their own family members under questionable cause and then abandoned, a pattern that compounded larger systemic failures and human rights abuses. Due to overcrowding and chronic underfunding and understaffing, patients were enlisted to perform menial tasks to maintain the ever-growing state facilities. It was, perhaps, naive of Kirkbride and fellow Quaker Charles Nichols not to anticipate how occupational therapy might devolve into unpaid labor. Following the Panic of 1873, with the industrial North distracted by economic depression, Reconstruction efforts in the South lost steam, and unpaid labor by asylum patients took a distinctly nefarious turn, as Southern doctors used freshly concocted mental diagnoses to commit recently freed slaves to asylums that were essentially work camps, in effect rebranding slavery as mental health care. These suppressed histories continue to resurface literally, as with the rediscovery of 7,000 graves at the Mississippi State Lunatic Asylum at Jackson, Mississippi in 2017. During the 20th century, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 proved the death knell for many asylums that relied on unpaid labor for their maintenance, and within 20 years, the pharmaceutical industry delivered the tranquilizers necessary to demobilize patients for the dwindling staff of state asylums. In light of these specters, hauntology offers a suitable mindset and methodology for examining these difficult histories. In his summary of the term, Merlin Coverley describes the logic of haunting as the belief that we may be haunted both by a past that refuses to be laid to rest and with the promise of a future that refuses to be extinguished. Distinct from terms such as retro or nostalgia, which reflect an obsessive consumption or preoccupation with the past, ontology offers a critical approach to the past that enables us to engage with specters we may have difficulty facing personally and culturally. Such specters include mental illness and the asylums that offer tangible reminders of painful individual experiences and, more broadly, the promising origins of a mental health care system that has gone awry. Viewed from a different vantage, those same asylums might yet provide access to a promising outcome by remapping history to find paths not taken and resurrecting the future inside of the past. By looking back to look forward, ontology explores patterns in time, revealing recurring themes and the forks in the road where things might have turned out differently, moments when new futures might have come to pass. Digging deeper into the past, a ontological approach scrutinizes standard historical narratives with close readings that unearth alternate histories and voices that may have been marginalized, if not deliberately suppressed and erased. While reconsidering such lost histories and the forks in the road, ontology may also revitalize unrealized projects and their unfulfilled promise so that they might yet come to be. An enriched understanding of Kirkbride Plan hospitals and their complex histories, for example, might help us imagine new ways that they might contribute to the local communities whom they have served for the past century and a half, while informing a candid reflection on our current crises of mental health care. Here are just a couple of notable forks or twists in the road. What if the Quakers' 1783 petition to abolish slavery had been adopted into the United States Constitution? 535 Quakers had signed the petition, including two of my Kirkbride ancestors, one being Robert Kirkbride, one of whom was in the representative group who presented the petition to Congress, stationed at that time in Princeton. Again in 1790, this time with the support of Benjamin Franklin, the Society of Friends advanced a new bill to abolish slavery in the U.S. Constitution. It failed by one vote. A representative from New Jersey, who would likely have voted in favor of abolition, was absent. At that moment in 1790, slavery was considered by many, including George Washington, and likely Jefferson, too, who curiously voted for abolition, as no longer economically viable. In an especially cruel irony, Eli Whitney, a staunch Northern abolitionist who believed his invention of the cotton gin would help end slavery, brought about the exact opposite result, reinvigorating the economy of the South and punting the question of slavery down the road. What if Franklin Pierce, the 14th U.S. president, had not vetoed the 1854 bill for the benefit of the indigent insane? The bill, championed by Dorothea Dix since 1848, had passed both the House and the Senate and would have provided a self-supporting federal system for national mental health care and support for the blind, deaf, and dumb by reserving more than 12 million acres of land. Pierce, a Northern Democrat who feared that abolitionists would destroy the country, alienated anti-slavery advocates by strengthening the Fugitive Slave Act to court the support of Southern states. Only Pierce, who is ranked one of the five worst presidents in the United States history, stood in the way of providing a comprehensive legislation to support the construction of physical infrastructures proposed in Kirkbride's treatise, published in the same year. From a hindsight view of asylum planning, it was perhaps the best of all years and the worst of all years. Quaker Enlightenment ideals, a balance of science and spiritual humanism, imbued the Kirkbride plan. And a century later, it was Quakers who blew the whistle on the mistreatment of patients at the very asylums they had helped create. During World War II, Quaker conscientious objectors such as Charles Lord were distributed among hospitals across the United States and covertly photographed the conditions of degradation at state asylums. In 1946, Life magazine featured Lord's photographs of the notorious Byberry State Hospital in Philadelphia, located just a few miles from the Friends Retreat, where Thomas Story Kirkbride completed his residency in the 1830s, accelerating the momentum of deinstitutionalization. What if JFK had not been assassinated in December 1963? JFK, who for very personal reasons, namely the botched lobotomy of his sister Rose, sought to deinstitutionalize mental health care and dismantle the state asylum-based physical infrastructure. In October 1963, he signed into law the Community Mental Health Care Act, which was conceived to create 1,000 community centers across the nation. Unfortunately, the bill included no funding for the centers, and he was assassinated before this could be agreed upon, with the consequence that only half of the centers came to be and none were fully funded. Although human behavior and decision-making were the primary cause of many of these slippery slopes, the buildings became the scapegoats. We're haunted by the materiality of psychiatric hospitals in the wake of their decommissioning and the poignant images of their desertion and decay, captured by explorers and documentarians and sensationalized in popular media. The dispossessed furniture, suitcases, and forlorn articles of clothing, the scattered snowfall of medical records left in reckless abandonment despite official policies to protect patients' privacy. The hydrotherapy tubs and examination rooms, layered in dust, yet disquieting still. We see also the marks left by the original fabricators, byproducts of the construction process, the pencil marks of carpenters, the chisel marks of masons, curious patterns of erosion left by water cannons in the sandstone columns and capitals of Greystone Park State Asylum, the subtle reminders of a devastating fire on November 26, 1930, the bricks of Oregon State Hospital, each bearing the stamp from the adjacent prison where they were produced, manifesting a micro-local history of interdependent correctional facilities that were revealed during the building's renovation. We're also haunted by the tangible traces of inhabitation in the Kirkbride hospitals, whether unself-conscious patterns of use, deliberate demarcations of resistance, or the terrifying stains of happenstance, as with the death of Margaret Schilling, whose remains were discovered in an attic chamber in Athens State Hospital over a month after her disappearance in December 1978. Outlasting efforts at erasure, her outline remains today by the process of adipocere. Such tragedies render palpable the dissonance between the initial genteel imagery of everyday life at a Kirkbride and its unanticipated actualities. Over the course of the 20th century, Carla Yanni has observed, the desire to keep patients out of institutions dominated policymaking. Such changes in policy reflected a dramatic shift in public perception toward the asylum, from a place of healing to a place of inevitable death, a prison with no escape. This change of public perception is reflected in our cultural media, specifically in our horror and fantasy literature and movies, including the stories of H.P. Lovecraft, for whom Danvers State Hospital offered a model for his Arkham Asylum. In the 1970s, Lovecraft's Arkham Asylum was transposed into Batman, with the Buffalo State Asylum as its model for the home of the Joker and Batman's Rogues Gallery. The ROC imagery has continued into the recent adventures of Harley Quinn. Speaking of prisons, the interwoven histories of mental illness and incarceration in the U.S. is itself a haunting narrative. This fraught interdependence is a ghost of the present, not merely of the past. We continue to be haunted by our inability to adequately support the mentally ill. Even if the asylums are plowed under in futile attempt to erase a difficult past, stigmas and challenges remain. Before asylums, the mentally ill were typically kept in jails and prisons. Ironically, those state asylums were systematically decommissioned across the 1960s and 70s in favor of community treatment. For various reasons, the community treatment plans proved inadequate, leaving many of the mentally ill homeless or in jail. As the Washington Post reported in 2015, the movement to deinstitutionalize the mentally ill began from a place of humanity, but it hasn't ended there. Based on 2016 data, pre-pandemic at that, over half of people in state prisons report mental health problems, but only 1 in 4 has received professional help in prison. Not only are we haunted by the Kirkbrides and their complex histories, but we ourselves haunt them. We probe in our minds what might have been had historical circumstances played out differently. And we imagine what might yet be if we are able to find new purposes for the structures that remain. If we are unsuccessful in doing so, how much more haunted will our future selves be by the missed opportunities these buildings offer? The language of ghosts has become an important way of talking about architecture and place. Each Kirkbride Hospital is a rich and unique three-dimensional document manifesting local variations of human concepts and conceits about reality and normality. Yet when considering the futures of the remaining Kirkbride Plan hospitals for the mentally ill, it may be tempting to argue, as I've heard on more than one occasion, that structures with such disturbing histories should be demolished out of respect for former patients. On one level, this reaction is understandable. Although awe-inspiring, these are buildings with complex and often painful histories. There are, however, powerful counterarguments. The first is ecological. The most sustainable building is the one you already have. And the erasure of such massive and historically layered three-dimensional documents is an unacceptable waste of embodied energy, irreplaceable material know-how, and cultural memory in a time of increasingly scarce and costly resources. Our collective imagination and resourcefulness, or lack thereof, are reflected in our capacity to find new lives for our buildings, places, and products, especially in light of the negative impacts of material extraction, transport, and construction on our shared ecosphere. If failure is the greatest teacher, we have much to learn from our histories of mental health care. And the Kirkbride Plan hospitals are vital to our illumination. Other nations and peoples have adaptively reused their buildings from time immemorial as a way of living with and learning from their histories, difficult or not. Can't we? A second counterargument is based on the hidden costs of forgetting. Erasure of the Kirkbrides and the stories they contain, whether by deliberate demolition or by neglect, is a form of group repression that only temporarily subdues the past. Such selective forgetting pushes distressing communal memories into our collective unconscious, and there they persist, deepening prejudices toward the mentally ill and breeding injustices toward one another. If we were to erase all the structures in the world that have difficult pasts, there would be very little of the built environment to think with. And we can't learn from our past to envision different futures without things to think with, object lessons. Ironically, many U.S. travelers will go to remarkable lengths to visit the Tower of London, the Bridge of Sighs in Venice, the Great Wall of China, or the Great Pyramid of Giza. All historic landmarks whose construction and histories are imbued with tragedy and human suffering. Yet do not blink at raising a structure of historical significance for another Walmart or an empty field. The demolition of Greystone was ranked among the top five architectural losses in 2015 by the National Register of Historic Places. A recent article in The Atlantic ponders why America still can't figure out how to memorialize the sins of our history, while offering powerful examples of memorialization from Germany and Belgium and the Netherlands that span in scale from concentration camps to Solpersteins, the stumbling blocks. Such memorials are critical to think with, both for cultural accountability and to energize transformative ideas. Over the past 8 years since Greystone's unnecessary and costly demolition, I've had the opportunity to contribute to several significant projects that emerged in its wake, including Johnson Casal and Blom's award-winning video, Greystone Rising, Matthews and Taglierini's documentary, Greystone's Last Stand, and the award-winning book, Greystone Park Psychiatric Hospital, Stephanie Kipp's research website, Greystone Oral History Project, and of course, Preservation Works itself, a nationwide nonprofit that formally absorbed Preserve Greystone's 501c charter once Greystone was lost. A number of us here today were part of that gathering at Traverse City in April 2015, represented by this poster, called by Christian Van Antwerpen as part of a last pitched effort to preserve Greystone. Over pizza that evening at the Kirkbride, Preservation Works was hatched. The importance of object lessons offers a third counterargument, which fuels our activities at Preservation Works, including research-driven projects to share knowledge about the Kirkbrides, to support local preservation efforts, and broaden appreciation of these irreplaceable structures. Some projects are already openly accessible on our website, including the Kirkbride Navigator, which you can use to plan your next road trip to Kirkbrides across the country, and which include facts, details about tours, and further historic information to supply your visits. Heroes of Preservation at several different sites where we have turned the corner successfully on preserving the Kirkbrides. And also several of my essays on ongoing questions, such as during the pandemic, the historic impact on Kirkbrides 100 years earlier during the outbreak of influenza. We're also currently developing a Kirkbride family poster with scaled plans that reflect the variations of Kirkbride plan, but also the progression of growth that led to their demise. Another new project that I want to mention is being launched this weekend. Some of you may have already experienced it during the tours. It's Sound the Asylum by Melissa Gray and David Morneau. Melissa and David are composers developing a growing catalog of immersive audio documentation, recording the resonant frequencies of the unrenovated asylum interiors. They'll be heading out to Athens in mid-October to document the West Wing before its planned renovations for independent senior living. To appreciate the full significance of the Kirkbride Plan hospitals, we must consider their landscaped grounds, cemeteries, and columbaria. In recent years, community-based efforts to preserve, reuse, and memorialize Kirkbride Plan hospitals have been complemented by grassroots efforts to memorialize and restore the identities of former patients who were abandoned to the state, buried, and forgotten. Such research is a form of archaeology, demanding curiosity and patient tenacity to sift through the layers of privacy laws, bureaucratic red tape, and other calcified traces of institutionalized stigma toward mental illness. Stigmas that persist and complicate the remembrance of these voices. The remaining Kirkbride Plan hospitals offer remarkable opportunities educationally and financially, and their revitalization is both common sense and achievable. To preserve buildings with complex histories, though, many voices need a seat at the table with a shared understanding that there isn't one single omniscient history, but many histories projected from different views, views that include an emerging generation of Kirkbride and asylum enthusiasts who do not share the stigmas about mental illness held by previous generations. Such cross-sectional advocacy might help us work through the stigmas and the difficult histories associated with mental illness, while preserving invaluable public infrastructures for renewed lives and service. At Preservation Works, we've just launched a newsletter in order to keep our members updated with all of the progress at various sites and these various research projects that we're involved in. Some recent examples of progress that we can feel very positive about include the Babcock in South Carolina, where the tower, the lantern, has just been restored and placed on top. Not only is it being used for residences and condominiums, but also the features that were significant in that community are being restored. This was just a month ago. At Bryce, ongoing alterations and transformations of the building for the University Performance Arts Center have been in process for several years now. We can certainly argue about the extent of which preservation and adaptive reuse is transforming it, and yet at the same time, the realities of the material physics of the buildings themselves have to be understood and embraced and incorporated into these alterations. Some of the structures, such as the interior walls at St. Elizabeth's, were only one brick wide. That is non-structural. That wall is not going to stand when you do interior renovations. These are discovered during the process of the actual renovation. So we have to be somewhat patient with the transformation of some of these buildings and their adaptations, even if it makes us less than happy from a preservationist standpoint. Broughton State Hospital, with its planning of a comprehensive adaptive reuse. And even just a day or two ago, we learned that if you look at the far right side here, you'll see the central main building of Traverse City was a casualty and was replaced with a 1960s flat top administrative center. The local ordinance is now just accepted a couple of days ago, being able to build above the restricted height, which opens the door for the Minervinis to finally achieve a dream they've been planning for years, to restore and rebuild that central main. Now, as a final example of the growing appreciation for the Kirkbrides, I'll share a handful of projects produced by my architecture students at Parsons School of Design. During the spring 2023 semester, our studio explored architectural remembrance and adaptive reuse for three Kirkbride Plan hospitals: Greystone Park Psychiatric Hospital, Hudson River State Hospital, and Athens State Hospital. And I can also note, I have permission to add, that we have just a few days ago received confirmation that the North Tower of Hudson is strongly defended from demolition, from seismic analysis and an independent contractor's structural engineer's report, as well as strong wording to preserve the facade of the north wing, along with the central main building, pictured here with my students and that local advocate, Yvonne Loby, in front. Across 15 weeks, the students developed proposals for two separate studio projects, designing memorials for Greystone and Hudson, and adapting the West Wing at Athens and Central Main at Hudson for senior living. With Yvonne's support, windows have been preserved from much of Hudson, and the students incorporated those windows into their proposals, such as Hazel Kim's project. In the senior living proposal, Serene Soriano took a slightly different angle of approach to interpret Hudson as a halfway house to retrain to retrain former inmates at the Dutchess County Jail, and the roof of Hudson would become a lantern visible for miles. At Athens, in particular, senior living in the West Wing is a central component of a comprehensive and cohesive mixed-use redevelopment plan currently progressing through county and state review. And you see here in a couple of the images how the students, Hazel Kim here, explored the very unique character and constraints of the room size. Room sizes that were the same constraints experienced by Hotel Henry and the Richardson in transforming those spaces for different modes of occupancy. And also transforming some of these interior spaces and sculpting them, bringing them back into everyday experience, such as the extraordinary attic spaces, which have been transformed at some locations, such as Traverse City, into remarkable apartments and living units. Based on these actual projects currently at development, in development at each of the three sites, students engaged with community members and local officials, including Yvonne here, as well as also Joe Ricci from Athens, the developer at Athens, who flew to New York in order to meet with my students and discuss the particulars of the project. Through them, through that direct engagement, they were able to learn about different modes and models of adaptive reuse and the complexities inherent to those processes. For the memorial project, the students had the opportunity to think with architectural fragments salvaged from Greystone and Hudson by volunteer satellite groups of preservation works for a future memorial project. I showed the images before from Hudson at Greystone. Due to the unflagging efforts of my colleagues and local officials and energized by the student proposals, a timeline to the future is finally taking shape. You see here the plan of Katie Kim, which approached a more distributed approach of arranging the fragments extracted by our group by vigilant participation during the demolition and with the support of the demolition company, North Star. We were able to preserve those items, and her proposal was to distribute them across the site in order to re-experience the full scale of the building. Whereas Sandro Tahan concentrated them, reconstructed part of the facade underfoot, horizontally, so that you are separated just by a few inches, but can see them in their original arrangement. And here you can see the momentum that is building right now, meetings that are taking place on finally utilizing these materials to produce a memorial for Greystone. Now, no doubt, there are still unanticipated twists and turns to navigate in all of these projects. But positive momentum has been steadily building over the past several years since the loss of Greystone, giving me the hope that perhaps it is possible to decouple the Kirkbride Plan hospitals from their many phantoms and to promote adaptive reuse rather than repressive and wasteful erasure. Perhaps it is possible to preserve and find new lives for these remarkable structures and their tangible lessons of architectural know-how, sustainability, and embodied energy. At Preservation Works, we'll continue to share what we're discovering, but please stay connected and keep us informed to keep you informed. And please also keep in mind how quickly things can change and how swiftly buildings can disappear. Will our future selves be haunted by a collective failure of our imagination? Will we learn nothing from the past and doom ourselves to repeat it? Those are still the phantoms that should frighten us the most. Thank you.